Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by just one of the regular Thinking Fellows, Dr. Adam Francisco. Hello, Adam.
Hello.
How you doing today?
All right.
It's been a while since we recorded. The last time we recorded was at Here We Still Stand, and unfortunately there were some complications with that recording, so we're making up for it. We're doing another episode, and today we're going to do just you and me because of some travel and scheduling conflicts and the like. And today we're going to talk about Luther, politics, and sort of the backdrop of what he was against politically in the medieval world, and then kind of what's happening in the Reformation. There's always a lot to talk about here. I think when Luther gets politicized or people talk about Luther and politics, I think a lot of times you get sort of this negative Luther, the great secular reformer type stuff going on. But
And that's even encouraged in some scholarship on Luther. There's a lot of, when it comes to his so-called two kingdom doctrine, which is actually really a complex of doctrines. And Luther doesn't radically change over time, but he develops over time. It's really easy to read something from, let's say, early Luther and come to the conclusion that he is a proponent of a distinction, if not a separation, of church and state, that in the what he called the left-hand kingdom or the secular realm was autonomous and so on. And there are scholars, I'm putting air quotes around that in, here in my office, that have perpetuated that. And, of course, we were talking before this that there are Catholic historians, primarily Catholic historians, who, like, for example, the book The Unintended Reformation, the author, whose name escapes me. I've got the book on my shelf here somewhere, but
we're sitting in your library.
Brad Gregory from Notre Dame University.
There you go.
Argues that Luther unwittingly pushed Europe. His doctrine pushed Europe in a direction such that the secular arena, the political arena, was completely divorced or autonomous from any sort of spiritual / religious concerns. And you can squeeze that out of Luther if you're just reading little bits. You know, Luther's one of these guys who's always quotable.
Yep.
And you can kind of turn him into all kinds of things if you want.
So, yeah, I mean, a quick Google search of Luther quotes will pull up pretty much anything you want to hear.
Yeah, and a lot of those quotes are, some of them aren't things he even said. I could turn Luther into almost a Muslim. You know, there's one place where he says, and this is, you know, Luther's very hyperbolic. He exaggerates to make a point. And one place he even says, when he was struggling with what he calls Anfechtung, a crisis of faith, if you will, wondering if he really was saved and whether he was saved by Christ and Christ alone or if he needed works. And he said on one occasion when he was wrestling with that, Muhammad almost became my prophet. So, I mean, you can pull stuff out of Luther and
Has written volumes and volumes and volumes across just a scope of different things going on, it's really easy to piecemeal together something you want to hear.
So for Luther and his political philosophy, if you want to call it that, there are so many books. There is a reason why there's so many books written on that subject or any subject to Luther, because every time a new historian or historical theologian reads a book and they think they get Luther wrong, they go back to Luther's sources and they argue against the book that they think is wrong and put forward a new interpretation. It just goes on and on, and that is especially the case with his political views. I think the first name is William Shearer, who wrote The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, argued, which Uwe Siemenetto has argued against quite convincingly, but Shearer argued that Luther was a thoroughgoing anti-Semite of the 20th century sort.
Yeah.
Which ain't true, but you can find stuff in Luther's works that makes him seem
find
if you look at it in the context and look at the development and what he's actually addressing, you don't actually find that. But anyway, I interrupted you about 5 minutes ago.
The
show.
Yeah, I mean, I think this does kind of put the modern backdrop on what you're going to then talk about, what was the actual backdrop of what was going on in Luther. During the Reformation, it's almost impossible not to speak politically, even when they're speaking theologically, right? The separation isn't there because part of the political government is the Pope, You have an emperor, you have kings and princes, all who are involved religiously and are in some form submit to the authority of the Pope before Luther, correct?
Yeah, and that's very important. The Reformation is, of course, preeminently a event in the church, and it's for Luther especially. It's when he talks about reform, as he put it, I think as early as 1520, he's interested in a reformation according to Holy Scripture, and especially a reformulation, not innovative reformulation, but a reformation of Christian doctrine based on the biblical text. So he's centered around theology. But nothing happens in a vacuum. There's so many things going on in the immediate backdrop to Luther's life that are political. Luther is involved in politics from his early days when he's asked, you know, just after he's nailing the 95 Theses to the castle church door in Wittenberg, he gets a letter from the secretary of his elector, his prince, Frederick the Wise. His secretary was George Spalatin, a good buddy of Luther's, who asked Luther, could you tell me and the elector whether it's legitimate or if the Crusades are legitimate? Because at that time, Pope Leo X in Rome is clamoring for a crusade against the Ottoman Turks. And actually had this vision that he could destroy the Ottoman Empire and that would expand Christendom and so on and so forth. And so that's early in Luther's reform work. And at the end of, all the way up until the end of his life, he's involved in even small little political disputes. For example, when he dies in his hometown, he had been there for, I think, at least a month, maybe up to three, negotiating an agreement between the various counts of Mansfeld over real estate issues, which is sort of weird, a pastor and theologian being involved in real estate disputes. Yeah. So so many things. But beyond the immediate backdrop is the larger late medieval backdrop. And I think, I mean, you could start a lot of places, but I mean, I'm going to go way back since historians are prone to do that. If you go to the end of the Roman Empire, so usually the usual date is 476 when Rome is not just sacked but conquered and the last of the Roman emperors deposed, Romulus Augustus, in the wake of that, Europe, Western Europe in particular, is kind of in disarray. You've got all these barbarian kingdoms around.
Yeah, they're smaller, feudal-type.
Yeah, and they come with their barbarian traditions. Some of them are Aryan Christians, but most are still pagans. But the Roman Empire is no longer around, at least in the West, and the only real stable institution that outlives the fall of Rome is the church.
Yeah.
And so the church is in kind of an interesting position as it's thinking about its place in society, and there's a pope at the end of the 5th century, Gelasius, pope from 492 to 496, if memory serves me correctly, and somewhere like in the middle of his papacy, he wrote a letter to the emperor in Constantinople, and he argues that in the world, God has given two powers, and the spiritual power and temporal or secular power. And in this letter, Gelasius goes on and argues in a way, it's not the clearest thing, it'll become clearer throughout the Middle Ages, that these powers are arranged hierarchically, that God gives two swords. And he's going to base this off of Luke chapter 22 in the 30s. It's right after the Last Supper. And Jesus tells his disciples, it's in the 30s in the verses. Mm-hmm. He tells his disciples that in the past he had, you know, they had done their work, their ministry, and they didn't have to worry about things, that he didn't have to bring a shirt or a coin purse or something. But now times are going to get rough. So if you have a shirt or a coin purse, exchange it for a sword. And as Luke goes on, I think this is verse 34, or right around there, it says the disciples said, Look, Lord, here are two swords. And that's, I bet that's Peter. Is Peter always?
Yeah, Peter's got his sword.
He's pretty
Peter
assertive.
Peter conceal carries, right?
Yeah. He's always got foot in the mouth disease. But Luke says, the disciple says, look, Lord, here are two swords. And presumably there's two swords propped up against the wall for whatever reason. And Jesus responds simply by saying, that is enough. And now you might read that. The kind of natural reading is Jesus saying, that's enough. Stop. Calm down, you know. But the way Gelasius and subsequent popes, all the way up into the later Middle Ages, interpreted that passage is that God is giving to Peter, you know, the first pope, if you will, in their view, these two swords, and they're symbolic for both spiritual and secular or political authority. But then Gelasius goes on, because the pope can't do it all, he then delegates the secular or political sword downward to kings, or in, after Charlemagne in 800 AD, to the emperor. And so it's all arranged hierarchically with kind of what some call the papal monarchy. The pope's the vicar of Christ, the head of the spiritual head of Christendom as it continues to develop in the Middle Ages. It takes a long time. But he's also the authority over the secular temporal rulers or magistrates, kings, and again, an emperor after 800 AD. The real definitive statement on this, what's called this two swords doctrine, comes in 1302, issued by Pope Boniface VIII in a papal bull, a papal declaration.
So that's a big gap between when...
Yeah, well, it's repeated. Now, so the early Middle Ages, up until about 1050 or so, we don't have a whole lot of material because, yeah, you know, it gets lost or whatever. But when we get to 1302, Boniface VIII will reassert what he assumes is the position of the papacy from Gelasius, and he would extend it back to Peter and to Jesus, yeah, of course, but throughout the whole Middle Ages in this papal bull. Again, it's like a declaration that it's part of canon law, right? The papal tradition. The bull is called Unum Sanctum. Just that title is given because it's the first two words in the bull, one holy Catholic church. And in that bull, it's not long. You could Google it, and it's been translated several times. But towards the end of that bull, he reasserts the two-sword doctrine, and in the end concludes that for anyone to be saved, and by it also unstated is for things to be ordered rightly in Europe as Corpus Christianum, the body of Christians or Christendom, all humans must submit themselves to the authority of the Roman pontiff. That's the view, that's the ideal for the papacy through the Middle Ages, at least up until 1302. Was that the reality? Absolutely not. It's messy in the early Middle Ages. I mean, again, most of those kingdoms are barbarian kingdoms, Arian Christians. In around 500 AD, right after Gelasius, you get the first, at least in name, Catholic kingdom, the Merovingians of France. They unite the Frankish tribes, and King Clovis is baptized, and so on. But it's a real messy history. It was never the reality that the pope actually wielded that much authority, such that the kings recognized his overlordship or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's the ideal. That's the doctrine. Now, when Boniface VIII declares that all must be subject to the Roman pontiff, in 1302, that's a really interesting claim in the 14th century, because not too long afterwards, the papacy is going to fall apart, if you will. By 1378, it's already starting to happen before then, already in 1307 to 1309, the pope will move out of Rome up into Avignon, France. And then over time, certainly by 1378, you've got a pope in Avignon, France, and then you've got a pope in Rome, and they're both claiming to be the Roman pontiff, right? The bishop of Rome, the real successor to Peter. And then the question arises in the Middle Ages amongst the common people, well, if I'm to be saved, I have to submit, and I have to submit to the Roman pontiff to be saved.
Which one?
Which one?
Yeah.
And on top of that, there are some real, if you will, socio-cultural issues that cause even more turmoil and angst amongst the people. In the 1300s also is the time of the Black Death, or the bubonic plague, where a third, maybe a half of Europe's population dies in about 5 years.
Yeah.
And you got, so you have famines, you got a little ice age begins to emerge, so that the you know, we always talk about global warming or now global climate change because some places are getting cooler.
It fluxes, yeah.
But it historically, it's always flux. And so with the cooling down of the climate, farming's not as, can't be as successful. So lots of issues in the what we call the late Middle Ages, right after Boniface VIII issues the Bull Unum Sanctum. And the late Middle Ages extend from 1300, well, maybe we'll just say 1302, up until Luther's time. Luther is very much a late medieval man in terms of when he lives, and certainly his worldview is shaped by the late Middle Ages. So it's in the late Middle Ages, though, after Boniface VIII, that you finally get within the Catholic Church challenges to this claim of papal supremacy. For example, Dante, the great poet of the Divine Comedy,
he puts popes in hell.
Yeah, I mean, he won't name Boniface VIII, but he gives physical descriptions of this pope who's in hell, not too far in terms of the layers mm-hmm. of hell from Muhammad, who's being ripped apart and his entrails tossed about. He puts Boniface VIII, presumably, in hell, but Dante will write a work called De Monarchia, or on Universal Monarchy, as it's oftentimes mm-hmm. translated, and he will argue that yes, there are two swords, there are two powers that God has handed down in the world. But those two powers aren't arranged hierarchically as Boniface VIII or Gelasius and every pope in between envision it, but rather God directly gives to the papacy the spiritual sword, and to the emperor, now that we're post-Charlemagne, at that time it was, I think, Henry VIII of Luxembourg, for those history buffs. It may have been Henry VII, but gives that authority directly to the emperor. So there's two hierarchies now, secular hierarchy and spiritual hierarchy. And so he will really encourage or endow in the secular authorities, emperor and kings, serious power that doesn't compete against the church, but it's not under the church. Then more importantly, a more significant player is this guy named Marsilius, sometimes Marsiglio of Padua, mm-hmm. who wrote a work right in the middle of the 14th century, I think 1340s, called Defender of the Peace or Defensor Pace. And that work, that's a remarkable work because it, for the first time since the days of Aristotle and the Roman Republic, asserts as its first political principle, popular sovereignty. Now, he's no democratic theorist, but Marsilius argues that God actually hands down authority on earth to people, and the people are divided into two, not classes, but for lack of a better term, we'll call them classes. There are the citizens, that's people who make up the population of a particular region, and from these people, and they could be clergy too, but the people, they, in whatever institutions they have, they elect or certify the king or perhaps an aristocracy or whatever as their leaders. But the authorities are subject to the people in a way. Mm. And Marsilius will even go so far as to say, as while the lawmaking, for example, might happen in the king's court, his bureaucracy, or in the aristocratic institutions, the people, however, have the final say because they need to test the laws and whether they're good, they're suitable for the common good. Then Marsilius also says there's another. So when God hands down authority to people, there's the clergy in particular, what he calls the faithful, those who are in church offices as a whole, as a council.
Yeah,
they're the ones who elect through whatever processes they decide are best, whether it's the College of Cardinals or whatever, they're the ones who elect the Pope. But the Pope is subject to the councils.
To the councils, yeah.
And that's where you get this, in the late Middle Ages, this movement called conciliarism. And when Luther's going through his trial from 1517 to 1520, 21-ish, finally at Worms in 21, where he takes his final stand, he, as he's doing his research in church history, because he's questioned by Eck and Kyaton and others, he discovers, originally he was kind of assumed that, of course, the Pope's the final authority when he's like a good papist in 1516 and even 1517. But then he realizes that that his understanding of the papacy actually wasn't in line with the teachings of the church. And in Luther's day and age, Leo X is reasserting Pope Boniface VIII's doctrine of the ultimate supremacy of the papacy, and a number of other things. And it's in that context where the Pope, though he didn't have the authority that Boniface VIII wanted him to have, or Gelasius long before him, but when the Pope assumes, Leo X assumes he does have the authority and begins applying secular responsibilities on Luther, coercive powers, not spiritual, but coercive powers, through, you know, that Luther is kind of pushed into his position of what he eventually becomes. But he'll declare himself a conciliarist, a Hussite. He'll be also labeled, it was actually, if the surest way to label your opponent as a heretic in the late Middle Ages is to call
them,
to call them a Marcellian.
Oh.
Somebody who's in this lineage. Whether they learn their stuff from Marcellus or not is not the...
Because he's seen as originating this pushing
against
papal authority.
Yeah, so in many ways, Marcellus could be labeled as one of these forerunners of the Reformation alongside Huss and Wycliffe, though he's not too interested in theology, per se. I mean, he is, but not
as much as he is political power.
Right, right. So that's the real big backdrop. And when we get to Luther, we don't see, as some assume, a complete overturning of that sort of medieval view of things, like a 180 overturning. But we see that Luther's going to put it on its side, kind of on a 90-degree, like on a horizontal plane. But I probably should pause here.
Yeah, we're gonna take a quick break. So we did background this first half, which is fantastic. A lot of good material here. We're gonna talk about a book real quick, and then we'll talk about Luther in a portion of change and living in this backdrop. All right. Welcome to our break. Today we're going to talk about a book that longtime listeners have definitely heard about and should own if they don't already. And if you're new to the show, I don't think we've talked about this book since the summer. So the book is called The Resurrection Fact. It is an edited volume. Dr. Francisco is one of the editors on that work, and he's also a contributor to it. He's got, is it one or two chapters in there?
One chapter and then the brief conclusion.
There you go. So I'm going to let him talk about it a little bit. It's a book on historical apologetics and mm-hmm. responding to, I would say, so you guys tried to go out and respond to the most modern forms of criticism, right?
Yes. Yeah. It was, so the other editor is John Bombaro, who's a pastor in San Diego and also a chaplain for the Navy. A former, I know Marines don't like saying former, but he's mm-hmm. former enlisted Marine, and also teaches at, I think, USD, University of Southern, or University of San Diego, and a PhD from University of London, if I'm not mistaken, so a pretty heavy-hitting guy,
yes.
Right? And I guess this is maybe two years ago, we thought we might write a companion volume of a sort to a book that Corey Moss and I edited called Making the Case for Christianity, which covered a lot of the primary apologetic themes, like how do you know God exists, and how do we know the New Testament is reliable, and so on. And John approached me, or we had talked about having one that focused on the central issue in at least the historical apologetic, that is the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And we decided very quickly that we wanted to address very modern criticisms, whether it be from like revisionist historians or the critics of the New Testament, like Bart Ehrman gets addressed in quite a few chapters in the book, and so on. And then, so then we collected, I don't know if collected is the right word, but gathered together a bunch of authors who we considered to be sort of the leading figures on these particular issues. From Mark Pearson, who's an expert on the New Testament and its credibility and its reliability, mm-hmm. to C.J. Armstrong, who's a colleague of mine in the history department here at Concordia, who's a classicist and knows the world of mythology, Greco-Roman mythology, very well, and he addresses modern claims that...
This is myth.
Yeah, that the New Testament authors are just sort of rehashing and historicizing these Egyptian and Greek dying and rising god myths. And then, you know, there's a couple other New Testament scholars who address it's a kind of a popular claim. Again, we saw it in the 19th century already, but in modern times, in the 21st century, there are a lot of historians who are saying, who realize you cannot get around the fact that Jesus died on a cross. Mm-hmm. Everybody but Muslims say that that's a bona fide fact. All the evidence says it's a fact, and you'd be foolish to discount it. He died on a Roman cross, he was put in a tomb, and that the tomb was empty on Easter morning. That's those are historic facts that are, I don't know if it's easily provable, but nobody really questions that except for a few outliers. So then how do you explain the empty tomb? And that's where all the division is. And some have said, well, based on all this eyewitness testimony that we have, you know, Matthew and John being eyewitnesses, Mark and Luke being companions of eyewitnesses to the resurrected Jesus, and then you've got other circumstantial evidence that suggests there are people, because there were, saying that this man Jesus who was put in the tomb there was walking around 3 days later. And so some historians have said, well, maybe they did see this. They thought they saw this person, Jesus, walking around, but it was a hallucination, or they saw kind of they projected a spiritual Jesus or whatever it is, but it wasn't a bodily resurrection. And so we've got several chapters addressing that. And every chapter carefully decided on addressing one particular school of thought or thinker as their foil, if you will, and most basically take an approach that goes after that particular thinker's thesis, and then after showing it's problematic, and then builds a case for the historical resurrection. So, and there are, I got the book in my hand here, 8 chapters, so 8 different things addressed. Yeah. So it's a short book. Some are written for a very popular audience. Some are more scholarly, but it's at the very least a good reference for the case for the resurrection.
You can get that book at shop.1517legacy.com or on Amazon. Again, the name is Resurrection Fact, and I will have that linked on the show notes as well to the 1517 Legacy shop. And again, on Amazon, it's really easy to search if you would like to buy it there. All right, so we talked about the political backdrop to the Reformation. We talked about the Middle Ages and what things looked like there. And now we have Luther in the middle of it, in the midst of his reforms. And mm-hmm. so, what are the important highlights there? We already know that his goal wasn't necessarily political reformer, right. But he definitely,
you can't get away from politics.
Yeah, but he's definitely,
if you're a person
in
living in a polity, which everybody does, except for maybe if you're in a hunter-gatherer civilization, and even then, it's kind of a polity of a sort. You can't get away from
politics. Even the Lutheran confessions, right, are signed by
princes
and
right.
Like
yeah,
that. I mean, no part of our theology really escapes this, especially the far, you know, as you go back.
Yeah, we're called, you know, some people don't like this, but generally speaking, Lutherans and Reformed and others are all called Protestants, and that's because the princes, the secular lords who were protecting these theologians like Luther and others, were labeled as the protesting princes. Mm-hmm. And they were protesting, these princes weren't so much protesting the theology of the Catholic Church. They were protesting the church's attempt to physically coerce these theologians into asserting the doctrine that they wanted them to assert.
Yeah.
So in terms of the source material for Luther's political view, his works are, you know, he's oftentimes referring to political things. But he did write some works that address particularly political topics. And I'm going to refer to his work on the freedom of a Christian later, but that's in 1520, he writes 3 what are oftentimes called his Reformation tracts, and the Freedom of the Christian is the one that has, I would argue, is probably the best way to understand Luther's political view in the long run. But
okay.
In terms of lengthy works where he's kind of hashing out a political doctrine or theory, if you will. 1523, he writes a work called On Temporal Authority, To What Extent It Should Be Obeyed. That's where he uses the term, the two kingdoms, and you know, he's famous for. Mm-hmm. 3 years after that, he writes a work called On Whether Soldiers Too Can Be Saved, which addresses the question that he was receiving day after day from people serving as soldiers, where they'd ask him, can I, as a Christian, serve as a soldier who is, in those days when the Ottoman Turks are rolling up through Hungary, is probably going to be in combat, and yeah, his duty is to kill others. And so he addresses that, but takes the opportunity then to address the larger question that was being put before him on whether Christians, as spiritual people, if you will, have any place in any sort of civil government, whether mm-hmm. they could hold political offices. And then 1529, 3 years later, he writes a work on war called On War Against the Turk, where he hashes out his just war doctrine, which, of course, is very much part of politics. I think it was von Clausewitz in the 19th century said that war is an extension of politics. Mm-hmm. And then after, let's just say, 1530, with the Augsburg Confession, there's all sorts of other things he addresses. But those three works are kind of where you can really get a view of Luther's so-called two-kingdom doctrine. And the thing you get, though, is that, like I said at the very beginning of the show, is sometimes Luther's not all that clear. He's not speaking out of both sides of his mouth, but as the situation changes, he's got to address different things. And it looks like he's not contradicting himself, but he's
bouncing back and
forth. Yeah, yeah. So
between what are the central kind of tenets that he's going after, yeah.
And for I think if we have to establish a model for it, for Luther, like medieval thinkers, he really believes, as a Christian should, that God is the ultimate sovereign.
Yep.
The creator of everything. He's the one who wields power and controls or has authority. Let's erase that word, controls, but although you can't erase it. But he wields authority over everything.
Yeah, that's especially clear, like things like bondage of the will.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. But for Luther, God rules over the world in two ways. In what he calls the spiritual or the right-hand kingdom, what St. Augustine would call the city of God, which isn't the visible church, but what we might call the invisible church, though there's... It's not the best way of describing it, but yeah. I don't know of a better way. That is, the God rules over the church as the sum total of all people who trust in Christ for their salvation. I think it's a small called articles, as it defines the church, says, the sheep who hear the shepherd's voice. Mm-hmm. That's the spiritual right-hand kingdom, and God rules over that kingdom through his word. And as Luther will put it, his word comes through a particular office, the office of the Holy Ministry. And you see that in the Augsburg Confession. I think it's, and our confessional guys are going to be appalled that I don't know exactly which one, I think it's Augustana 5, that after the doctrine of justification, it goes on and says, and God has established the office of the Holy Ministry for the proclamation of this. That's my paraphrase of Augustana. It's ruled by the Word of God. There's particular vocations that are under normal circumstances there to proclaim His Word, to interpret His Word, to dispense the visible Word, if you will, the sacraments. It's a word that is not. I've been using the word authority and rule. It's a word though that is not. Always imposing. It's a word that is divided, rightfully so, between law and gospel, and the gospel will always predominate. But it's spiritual. And one thing that's oftentimes missed with Luther, when people look at Luther's view of politics or this two-kingdom doctrine, is that Luther thinks very, like a lot of people in the Middle Ages, modern people don't think this way necessarily, but in the Middle Ages, in the ancient world, people thought teleologically. They thought about the particular ends to things. And for Luther, the spiritual kingdom has a particular end, and it's not in time and space. It's not to create some sort of Christian...
rule over
the world. Yeah, yeah. It's outside of time and space. And Luther's, you know, he's Augustinian monk, or a former Augustinian monk at this point. though I don't know if he ever renounced his vows. Did he? Anyway, that's a side issue. But like Augustine in his great work, The City of God, talks about the city of God, kind of like Luther talks about the right-hand kingdom, that those who are citizens in that kingdom or in that city, they are pilgrims here on earth. Their ultimate destiny, if you will, is outside of time space. It's in heaven with God, enjoying him forever, if you will. Now, Augustine, when he talks about Christians being pilgrims on earth, he doesn't talk so much about Christians playing an active role in what he calls the city of man, or what Luther will call the city, the left hand or secular or temporal kingdom. Luther, however, does he's quite an advocate of Christians playing an active role in the secular arena. A government for Luther isn't just a necessary evil, as Augustine might consider it. That is something that arises as a consequence to the fall into sin. But government for Luther can play a positive role. And in this left-hand temporal political kingdom for Luther, he believes the leaders in this kingdom, their authority, not the particular people necessarily, but just the fact that there's government and authorities established, that's from God. And Luther will consider them fulfilling holy offices. You know, they're real holy divine offices in one place. And this sounds pretty extreme, but when Luther is talking about the soldier, and he says when the soldier is fulfilling his obligation in the field, killing and stabbing to death the enemy, he is doing a divine work. And so it's like that sort of language that it makes it kind of confusing with Luther. But he really believes that the left-hand kingdom is God working through a mask, government and earthly authorities, to execute his will on earth. And in the left-hand kingdom, the church actually is in the left-hand kingdom. Much of the church, the visible church, the institution, its property, the laws governing it. And towards the end of his life, Luther actually has a pretty high view of the state, if you patronizing, endowing, protecting, certainly, and even pushing the church when it sees the church or it's been advised that the church is in error. I mean, that's something that a lot of people don't focus on, but it's there.
Especially in America, since our polity is so much different than what Luther was living in.
And that's because of historical circumstances. But Luther is a state church kind of guy, but not in the modern sense of the term. But in this left-hand kingdom, I think it's best to understand what that is in light of what's called Luther's three estate doctrine. Luther believes that humans live in three particular states. It's called the Dreiständelehr, three stations, if you will. And those three estates are the church as a public kind of institution. It's the family or economium, what he calls it, economium, and that means the household, and it also involves economics, the art of acquisition, and so on. And then the third estate is the political estate. That's like real coercive power. And all people exist in those estates. And the way you live your life in the left-hand kingdom for Luther is to see yourself freed by the gospel, freed from fear of judgment, but in your freedom before God, that's an accomplished fact through the death of Christ and the righteousness imputed to you from that death and the resurrection, you're now free to serve in those and fulfill the obligations and your particular vocations in those estates. And now I'm going to try to tie it all back to his work from 1520 called On the Freedom of Christian. In that work, he puts forward two theses, two assertions about the freedom of a Christian. On one hand, he says a Christian is perfectly free, Lord of all.
Yep.
And on the other hand, though, almost paradoxically, he says a Christian is also utterly dutiful, servant of all. And you think, what does that mean? And I think the best way to understand it, and I know it can be controversial in our times. I don't know why it is, but I'm told it is. It's best to understand that in light of his doctrine of the two kinds of righteousness, I think, which Luther at one point calls the nut of his theology. And what he meant by that is when he's talking about the freedom of a Christian, he's like I said a little earlier, he's talking about that a Christian is absolutely free from the terror of the law, the consequences of failing to fulfill the law completely before God. He's completely righteous in the eyes of God because of the passive righteousness imputed to him through faith on account of Christ alone, by God's grace. We have to add that in there, too. But what does that mean then, that you're free to do whatever you want? And Luther, like Paul, would say, heavens no. You're free now to serve your neighbor. You're free now to play. If you're good, Luther says, if you're a good executioner, volunteer to be an executioner for the state. You're free to fulfill all these obligations that are necessary for peace and order in your particular polity.
You no longer have to worry about how that vocation deals with the state of your salvation.
Right. Now you're free to fulfill your obligations, to be virtuous, if you will, to be ethical as best as you can in a way that's not self-absorbed or self-serving, because it doesn't matter to God. It matters, but if you fail as an executioner or you're a soldier and you aren't the best soldier that's ever lived, you're not a hero, there's not eternal consequences for that. There might be, and Luther's pretty strong on that, there should be consequences in everything on earth. If you fail as a student, for example, to do your work,
you should get an F.
You should get the appropriate grade. So in the right-hand kingdom, grace, gospel predominates. In the left-hand kingdom, Luther believes that law predominates. One more thing. I know we're kind of getting close on time. Luther, however, in one section on his work, in a work where he addresses the princes, the leading citizens, governors, magistrates, the electors, emperor, king, or what have you, he says the best model of government is the one modeled after a family, which is he's very much against what everybody's interested in today, bringing down the patriarchy. Luther's very much a patriarchist, if you will, understood correctly, in that he thinks that the way a father rules over the family or leads his family is probably a better way of putting it. That's the model of the prince or the public servants who have tremendous amount of authority. And what he meant by that is the father isn't going to deal with things always by the letter of the law. He's going to recognize that circumstances are in many ways going to determine punishment or reward and so on. And last thing he says, and so for a prince, the most important thing for a prince to be aware of or to exhibit in performing the duties of his office is not that he knows the law to a T, and it's certainly not that he's just grace abounding everywhere where he lets off every criminal, but it's that the prince have common sense, reason, and knows when to be charitable, but also when to punish. And for him, it's sort of like right in the middle of the old question in politics. John of Salisbury, the 12th century in Britain, asked the question, I think maybe first, is it better for the ruler to be feared or loved? And John of Salisbury said, loved. Machiavelli famously said, who's writing about this time, it's better for him to be feared. And Luther says it's neither. The ruler is going to make mistakes. He needs to learn through experience, common sense, when to apply the law fully, when to withhold it. For poor people who owe money, if they can't pay it, he's going to say they should extend some charity if the people they owe money to already have enough money.
Yeah. And
so he's very commonsensical, very pragmatic in like his real political views on how governance should be executed. So, I mean, I could go on and on about this, but I think
we're coming to about an end. This is always, to me, this is always an interesting conversation in light of kind of what you hear around the fallout of Reformation Day every year. Because, Reformation Day comes and all us Lutherans get really excited, right? And then article after article online comes about all these political impacts of Luther. And so I think stuff like this is always a good reminder of what was the actual political situation he was in. Yeah, and it's not, it is not a perfect mirror to what we have now. And then you can still take some of these kind of these highlights from Luther, right? Of these ideals of the two kingdom theory and three states and how he views government. And we can try to apply them perhaps to our life now, understanding that
It's very
circumstance
different.
Is very different.
Extremely different.
So, yeah, I find this kind of stuff very valuable, especially especially in light of Two Kingdom stuff that I think often gets kind of misinterpreted and things like that. So thank you for sitting down with me and, and doing this. It's
my
great
pleasure.
To have you on the show. Listeners, we will have, once scheduling kind of settles down, this is holiday season again, we'll have everybody back on the show once again.
Is this going up? On November 10th, today? That's when we're
going. It's going up next week. Oh, yeah, today's Luther's birthday.
Right? Yeah, that's important.
Yeah.
I was going to say it's also the Marine Corps' birthday.
Oh, wow.
And it's also the Veterans. Well, tomorrow is Veterans Day properly, but today it's when it's observed. So,
interesting. So why school in?
Wrong question.
That's not the right question. All right. Thank you for listening. We'll catch you next time.